Job was sitting in an ash heap, scraping himself with a piece of broken pottery. Let's pick up reading this morning. We are looking in chapter 2 at the second test of Job. And last Lord's Day morning, we looked at the first assembly, which took the first 7 verses of that chapter. Let's start reading in verse 7 this morning and read down through the end of the chapter where we deal with Job's illness, Job's second reaction, and the arrival of Job's friends. And then hopefully this morning we will get into Job's lamentation, which comprises chapter 3. Following the reading of this passage, I'm going to ask Eric, if he will, to lead us in our opening prayer. So Satan went forth from the presence of Jehovah and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot under his crown. And he took him a potsherd to scrape himself therewith, and he sat among the ashes. Then said his wife unto him, Dost thou still hold fast thine integrity? Renounce God and die. But he said unto her, Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips. Now when Job's 3 friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, and they made an appointment together to come to bemoan him and to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice and wept. So they rent every one his robe and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. If we could just take everything that had happened to Job, the loss of his physical estate, the loss of his family, and set it aside, assume that it had never happened, is there anybody who would still like to be like Job as we find him here in chapter 2? How many of you have ever had a boil? I see a few hands going up and a few grimaces with the hands. You remember them, and you remember them well, because they are not pleasant experiences. Imagine, if you will, not having a boil. But imagine, if you will, being covered with boils from the crown of your head to the sole of your foot. It is not a pleasant experience. What kind of disease it was, we do not know. Writers have speculated. They've made every kind of guesstimate, I think, that it is possible to make. But the truth is, there are not even enough clinical observations in the book of Job for us to make a guess even today that we can have any confidence in as being accurate. But the important thing, the thing that Job is trying to impress upon us, is not the nature of his disease so much as it is the dread nature of that which befell him. And if you go through all of the book of Job, you discover little hints along that make it even worse. We know that he had some kind of skin disease that covered the body. We know that it was some kind of skin disease that developed infections that darkened, that's in chapter 30, that peeled, that's in chapter 30, that developed erupting pustules, that's in chapter 7. Accompanying this, there seemed to be an emaciation, chapter 19. There was fever, chapter 30. There was depression. There was weeping, there was sleeplessness, there was nightmares. To make matters worse, Job even had bad breath, chapter 19 and verse 17. He had bad eyesight. He had rotting teeth. And he had a gaunt, hollow-eyed look. Not a very pleasant description, is it? Not something that you and I would really want to develop and have. We can think of several diseases we would rather have than what Job was experiencing on this occasion. And when Job was stricken, the scripture tells us that Job went out and made his seat among the ashes. Now, it's very common to dump your ashes outside the city. They didn't have their environmental programs in place at the time. This might indicate that Job was some kind of an outcast. Some suggest that this shows that he had leprosy, because that's what you did with lepers. You put them outside the gate and would not let them come in and associate with the folks who didn't have the disease. That may or may not be so, but there is at least one indication that it might not be so, and that is the fact that Job's friends went out and sat in the ashes with him. And ordinarily, that kind of association was not had with one who was a leper. It may be nothing more than Job's recognition of his new estate. And the new estate of Job was that he was nothing more than a piece of human refuse. A piece of human trash, if you will. And about the only thing that could be done with Job, that he at least recognized, was to be put outside the gate. And so he went, he sat. And as I suggested in our opening comments, we see Job sitting in the ashes. And he has a piece of broken pottery, and he's scraping the boils, the pustules that are itching him to... Have you ever tried to keep from scratching when you're itching? Has anybody ever been able to do it? Probably not. And so here's the picture we have of Job. And it's at this time that we get Job's second reaction, verses 9 and 10. This time, notice that the pattern changes, because this time, Job's wife comes on the scene. You notice anything here on the part of the devil? Do his temptations get more severe? Do the trials begin to come from directions and sources that may create a little more trouble for Job in resisting them? Let me ask you a question. Maybe I shouldn't ask who is, but maybe I can ask it at least this way. Who should be the nearest on earth and the dearest on earth to you? Your spouse? Your husband? Your wife? That's what I always think of when we sing, "Does Jesus care?" Does Jesus care when I've said goodbye to the dearest on earth to me? When my sad heart aches till it nearly breaks, is it aught to him? Does he see? The devil has failed with Job's physical estate. He has failed by coming at Job through his children and destroying his children. And now he comes through the nearest and dearest on earth to Job. But what does he do first? He puts Job in the ash can. You remember the wedding ceremony? For better or for worse? I don't think it was that bad back in Job's day, but in our day and age, we sort of like for better, but we sort of cross our fingers on for worse, don't we? And for most of us, in this day and age, we are willing to stay with the spouse for better, and maybe even for not so good. But let me tell you, when it gets to worse, and when worse comes to worst, most folks in this day and age have drawn a line and they have said, this far and no more. Now, I don't know whether that's what happened in Job's situation or not. As a matter of fact, we really don't know what kind of woman Job's wife was, because the only time she appears is right here. She comes in and she's gone. I do know that commentators have been pretty hard on her. All right? And we don't remember those things. You look at the commentators, and they're rough on Job's wife. You know who's the roughest? It's not the Muslim commentators. It's not the Jewish commentators. It's the Christian, broad sense, commentators who are hardest on Job's wife. Now, I don't know. Maybe, as Bob suggests, she cracked first. That's possible. And there certainly is an interpretation of the statement of Job's wife, why don't you just curse God and die? What good has your integrity done you? That could lead one to that conclusion. But is it not also possible, as Bob also suggests, that Job's wife is being at least a little defensive of Job, her husband? What good has you trusted in God, and God picked on you? And when God picks on my husband, God picks a fight with me. So why don't we just end this thing? Maybe she just had gone as far as she could go in seeing Job in his misery, seeing Job in boils, seeing Job out in the ash heap. Her children were dead. Her life was gone and destroyed. Maybe we're just a little tougher on Job's wife than we ought to be, but whether that is true or not, and whether it was witting or unwitting, it at least does seem to be true that here the devil had an ally, and that through Job's wife, the statement was made urging Job to do what the devil had early predicted Job would do. Why don't you just curse God and die? He is not. He will use whatever he can. And we need to be alert. As Peter said, the devil, your adversary, goeth about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. All right. What is Job's reaction to his wife? Does he call her wicked? All right. That's his reaction to the trial. But of his wife, what does he say? You speak as one of the foolish women speaketh. He doesn't call her wicked. He does call her foolish. He does suggest, as the word suggests, that she was lacking in discernment. And this, I think, may get to the thought that she thinks God has treated Job badly. And because she thinks God has treated Job badly, she thinks that God deserves a curse. But Job finds nothing wrong in God. Well, I'm sure he looked like death warmed over. Well, that's where Dr. Kevorkian comes in. Because people who are in that kind of pain and misery want out of it. And we're going to see in Job's lamentation that his greatest desire was to die. He wanted nothing more than that. Wished he'd never been born, and having been born, he wished he could die. But Job says, "You're one of the foolish women." And it's here that Job's trials enter into this new phase with his wife and his friends who should be helping him, but who actually put him in more pain and difficulty than he had been in before. Job's reaction, as suggested, is at least the first time he says, "God gives, God takes away." And here his reaction is, it's equally right for God to give both good and evil. Shall we not receive evil from the hand of God? That word receive does not indicate a passive vessel that has something poured into it. It's a word that indicates an active cooperation and not just simple submission. Notice when Job says, "Shall we not receive this evil from God as well as good?" That he does not blame God. He does not blame himself. God understands. Job is confident of that. Job is confident that he does not. And to receive or to accept this evil from God implies an illogical dimension to life that really is beyond what you and I are able to understand even by faith. But by faith, all we can do is just trust and say, "Fine, it's in your hand, God." And that's where we find Job at this point in time. And I want to suggest something for you to keep in mind as we go through the book of Job. And that is that this kind of faith is the only alchemy that you're ever going to find that's going to change the lead of sorrow and suffering into the gold of peace. It is going to be the only thing that you're ever going to find that's going to change sorrow into joy, that's going to change sour into sweet. And the reason that you and I don't find it so often is because the cost is so high. It's just a whole lot easier for us to lower our estimate of God than it is for us to elevate our faith to that higher plane. If you don't remember anything else, remember that as we go through the book of Job. And at this point, Job gave up. Is that what it says? In all of this, Job did not sin. God, let me go out. And let me lay my hand on Job's possessions and, as I told you a Sunday or two ago, don't like to cuss in class, but it's a literal translation of what the devil said, "I'll be damned if he won't curse you to your face." Strong language. But Satan lost. Well, maybe this first test just proved that it wasn't severe enough. God, let me go out there and let me lay my hand on Job and he'll curse you to your face. And God said, "Okay, just don't kill him." And Satan loses again. Job maintains his integrity. In all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. Some people come in and they say, well, that just means Job didn't say it. Job thought it. Isn't it just as wrong to curse God in the mind as it is with the lips? That's foolishness. People don't know it if you think it. People know it if you say it. But God knows it if you think it. That's true. There may be a suggestion, but I'm not going to reach conclusion. I'm going to suggest here in a minute that God has a great deal of understanding. Well, in a minute, maybe a little stretch. Today, next Sunday week, we will get there. I'm going to suggest that God has a great deal of patience with people as they express. Well, all we know about his wife is what is there. The Scripture doesn't say, and I'm going to leave it with God. He can handle it, I think, adequately. He did indeed. You know, truth of the matter is, if Job's words were different from what was in his mind, had not Satan already corrupted him? Absolutely. And so he did not sin. He did not sin with his mouth. If any man is able to bridle the tongue, the same of the man is perfect. So he did not sin with his tongue. Absolutely. Now, let me suggest this. Some say, okay, we can at least concede here that Job later fell into some sinful statements. And it will be true that as we progress through Job, we're going to find some of his statements that may be sort of shocking to you and to me. But keep in mind Job chapter 38 and verse 2. The only censure that God ever made of the speech of Job is that Job spoke in ignorance. And if we be censured for that, then we're all in trouble. He is still in pain. One thing, hopefully, doesn't look like we're going to make it this morning. We may get a little bit there. But one thing I want you to keep in mind as you read through Job's lamentation in chapter 3 is that as you hear Job lament, you never, ever hear Job lament the loss of his wealth or the loss of his health. It is Job's perceived loss of relationship with God that he laments. So read carefully through there. It is true that we say things when we are in pain. But keep in mind that as Job speaks, it is his loss with his relationship with God that is driving his agony. Bill? I think it could be said as well that his wife spoke in ignorance. I think the statement could apply to both. That is true. What we have from the lips of Job here in chapter 2 and verse 10 may be the last clear expression of a clear mind on the part of Job and an unshaken faith that will pass his lips before, as one commentator said, he sinks beneath the waves. There are going to be times when Job is going to seem to have come unhinged, but as we go through the book of Job and we hear the agony of his soul, the thing that you and I need to do is to continually remember Job as we see him here in the prologue. because it is here that we see Job as he really is. Finally, in chapter 2, verses 11 to 13, we have the arrival of Job's friends. What was the basis of the friendship between Job and these three folks? All wealthy. That may be. That may be. Because not just everybody could pack up and go to another land to visit a friend in that day and age. And that's what these three fellows did. Truth of the matter is, we don't know the basis of the friendship. We don't know its past history. We don't know how they met. We don't know if they were old college buddies, for instance, that decided, well, we'll just wind up, go down and see Job this weekend. But let me ask you this. Are these true friends? I'm getting a, well, yeah. Why do they have to be? There's got to be a sense of loyalty. There's got to be a real friendship. These three friends lived in three different countries. We're not exactly sure where they were, but somewhere in the vicinity. And they made an appointment. Somehow they got together and made an appointment to meet. And the very purpose for that meeting was to go and to visit with Job. They had heard of his travail. Is it not the truest of friends, who upon hearing of the difficulty of another will drop everything and travel and go and stay 7 days by the bedside of a friend? I submit that's true friendship. Yes, Nita? Yeah, who wants to go sit in ashes? And that's what these fellas did. They had heard of Job's travail, maybe even of his condition, but they did not hesitate. They went. There isn't any reason to doubt that they were genuine friends. There's no reason to doubt that their motives were sincere. Their behavior shows sympathy for Job's plight. They may have been, and we'll suggest were, very tactless on occasion. They were undiscerning. They spoke also in ignorance. But there's no reason to suppose that their words had any other motive than to do that which was good for Job. The scripture is silent as to whether they brought other things. We can say maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But I think the emphasis is that the greatest gift they brought was their friendship. And they came to console and comfort him. They might have brought something else. I don't know. It is a device which the author uses to set up the discussions that are going to follow for the friends to be present to discuss the workings of God with man. So there are a lot of unanswered questions. The reason for the 7 days is that that was a common period of mourning. If you remember, I forget the chapter and verse, when Ezekiel saw the captives, he sat down by the river for 7 days. And that's just a common period of mourning. And so they came and they sat there in silence for that period of time. All right? And that's very true, that sometimes the very best thing we can do, and often the only thing we can do, is just to be there and lend our presence and our support. All right? Frankly, I hadn't thought about that. But that's true. I mean, not many of us like to sit and hold on to a lightning rod in a storm, do we, Stan? And as you suggest, that's sort of what they were doing. His wealth is gone, his health is gone, his children are gone. And so, I'm really busy this week, Joe, but I couldn't. I can understand that. All right? And if they were looking for leftovers and sort of scavenging off of Job's misfortune, when they got there, they wouldn't have sat down in the ashes with him. Most of us will go so far to take advantage of folks, but when it really inconveniences us, we've gone as far as we can go. That is true. What you're saying is, you have known some folks who are ready to rejoice with those who rejoice, but leave you to weep alone. That is true. And they saw Job and did not recognize him. That tells us a little bit more about the physical condition in which these folks found Job. And they sat there for 7 days, and nobody said a word. They didn't focus on some philosophical question of undeserved suffering, but they focused on one man's physical existence in pain and in grief. As Marilyn suggested earlier, what was there to be said? They were horrified. They were speechless. But they were true friends, bringing to Job's ash heap the compassion of a silent presence. But let me suggest to you that while they were sitting in silence with Job, there were things going on in their mind, because while they sat in silence, they were condemning Job, because in their minds, his sin had brought all of this upon him. End of chapter 2. And it's not a friendship, but a selfishness that says, I can't stand. I can't bear. Because the key word there is I, or we, which is simply a plural of the first person. That's right. As a matter of fact, when we get into Job's lamentation, I'm going to suggest to you that hope and despair go hand in hand. And that the truly despairing, in some senses, may be the only truly hopeful. Now, you be thinking about that and see if you can figure out how we're going to get there. But I think we can. Appreciate your prayer. Really appreciate the fine comments and questions that you had this morning. You're thinking about the book of Job, and that's good. For next Lord's Day morning, read chapter 3, Job's Lamentation. It gets us into the second major section of the book. Thank you for your presence this morning.